I'd like now to welcome Eric Tonesmeyer. He is author of the book Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One Tenth of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And this is such an interesting story. I mean, there's a lot about plants and urban gardening, and it's also really the story of your life. You got interested in plants and ecosystems really early on. How did that interest develop, and how did you develop it?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate that when I was in, among lots of great things my parents did and so on, I was fortunate that I was in a program at a local nature center when I was in fifth grade, where we spent a week out there at their site, and every day we would go and sit quietly in the same spot for half an hour or something and draw pictures or talk about what we observed, and somehow that just really drew me in. And I was, again, fortunate right after high school to be able to go and spend almost a year working there and do the same work with young people. So that was very very fortunate. It was very fun. And I also found out about permaculture while I was there, which is sort of about not just observing ecosystems and keeping your hands off them, but actively engaging to create these food-producing ecosystems. And that excited me so much that that's what I've spent my whole life doing.
Permaculture is such an interesting concept, and there's a lot of things that go into it, and I think a lot of people have different definitions for permaculture, but the term comes from permanent agriculture and permanent culture. And one of the things that I love about permaculture is it's basically, how do you set up ecosystems that feed you and also basically take the least amount of maintenance possible?
Absolutely. I find I have plenty of other things to do besides garden. So I like to get things set up so that it works relatively low maintenance once it's established. And we've had some really good success with that here, and also some definite proof that we can't do it with zero maintenance yet at all. But it's been, for example, we have some crops that come back. We have a perennial broccoli that's now 12 years old, comes back every year, makes broccoli. We barely have to do anything for it at all. And I like that. When you can set a bunch of things in motion like that, then you have this very low maintenance perpetual food producing machine. That's nice.
Somebody called it, you go from designer to recliner.
Yes, yes. And unfortunately, there's still a fair amount of harvesting involved, and you really can't get away from that. I think that's the irreducible minimum of low-maintenance gardening, is you still have to do plenty of harvesting. Can't get around it.
Well, of course, the big part is the designing of a permaculture garden. And in the book, Paradise Lot, you talk about kind of how you got to this place where you and your friend Jonathan Bates bought a duplex in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and a tiny, I mean, tenth of an acre really is a pretty small space, started a permaculture garden there. And the thing that's really, to me, just like rocket science about permaculture is that it's not only learning about each plant, it's learning about how they interact with each other. It's about learning about the insects and worms that affect them. And basically, each part of the system is connected to every other. And that is something that you can't just learn through brute force. It really takes a lot of different kinds of learning.
And that, for us, that's been interesting. Some of it's been book learning. You know, I've combed through many, many, many books on plants and ecology and agroecology and so on. But we also spend a lot of time with observation, setting up a chair out in the garden and watching the insects on the different kinds of flowers to see which ones the beneficial insects prefer, and rolling over logs and seeing what's crawling around under there. And so we try and really engage in that information as much as we can. And permaculture is about taking our understanding of, in this case, the plants, but it can be whatever elements you're trying to put together, looking at for each one what its niche is. What does it need? What does it produce? What are the conditions it wants to be in? And trying to plug those pieces together to create a living ecosystem. where every piece is getting what it needs, and its products are being put to good use by somebody else, and it's in the ideal conditions for itself to be as happy as it can possibly be. And so we have plants that fix nitrogen, and we have plants that attract beneficial insects, and we have plants that are preferred egg-laying site or overwintering site for beneficial insects. We have plants that like shade, and we have plants that like sun, and we're trying to put all those things together, and you end up with a lot of different layers of things happening all at once. It's really interesting. It's very, very fun.
It sort of reminded me when you were talking about, one of the ways that you guys do pest control is having beneficial insects that eat the bad insects. And for all the world, it really is also the way we work. We have all kinds of bacteria inside of ourselves that eat the bad bacteria, so to speak. And it just made me think that the ecosystem of our bodies and the ecosystems around us are very similar.
They much more than we tend to think, and I've been reading some studies lately on what they call the human microbiome, all the different kinds of organisms that live in our digestive tract, and there are an awful lot of parallels to the soil ecosystem, for example. I find that
right.
Really very, very interesting. And in our garden, we haven't sprayed anything at all for 6 and now going on 7 years. Not even anything organic. We just don't spray. And we have a few things that are problematic, like slugs in a wet year are bad for us, and occasionally some beetles. But we don't have any trouble with aphids. We don't have any trouble with caterpillars. There's just whole classes of insects that we don't have problems with. And even when we had recently, for the first time, spider mites showed up, which are really devastating. They came through and they ate almost everything. They ate many different kinds of crops. Then we kind of sat there and we said, oh, should we kill these things? Should we spray them? What are we going to do? We're reading about them, learning about their life cycle. Meanwhile, something shows up called a spider mite destroyer, which is a tiny little black ladybug. And within a couple weeks, all the spider mites were gone. Ever since then, we have a persistent, very low level of spider mites and spider mite destroyers. So they've just become part of the ecosystem. And that tells me that we've created something here that has some resilience, some ability to bounce back and take care of itself.
And one of the things that's interesting about that is the spider mite destroyers, you didn't have to order them. They just showed up by themselves.
They just showed up, and in fact, they eat some things besides spider mites, so maybe that some of them were already here eating some of the low level of aphids that we have, or maybe they were here for all the nectar on all the different flowers we have. But we created conditions for them by providing habitat, providing water, providing nectar, and not spraying. It was really cool when it happened. We were scared we were going to lose everything, but it worked out very nicely.
We're talking to Eric Tonesmeyer about his book, Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One-Tenth of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Now, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about the evils of corporate agriculture is monoculture. Let's talk about what you do, which is polyculture. What does that mean?
Well, there's a couple different ways to do polyculture. One is, let's say in the same garden you might have a row of tomatoes and then a row of cabbages and then a row of something else, and that would be what we would call intercropping, where you're growing sort of little monocultures right next to each other of different species. And we do some of that, but we're also really looking at a true polyculture where the plants are growing right in with each other, and you try and line that up to have a maximum of cooperation between them and a minimum of competition. So you need to know what they need and what they can offer in order to do that properly. And I would say we're to the point now after all these years where we have a 50% success rate with new polycultures we design. So a lot of them don't work, and that's fine. You can try another one the next year. We've had success with a bunch, and we actually created a wiki online where people can share their results doing that, which has been a lot of fun to see what people are trying.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the amazing ways that permaculture works, is that any new technology, like having a polyculture wiki site, helps everybody, no matter how close or far away they are, be part of this community of ever more effective gardening.
And we're doing our best to share our mistakes. We put a lot of mistakes in the book, too. We try and be honest about all the things we did wrong, or we knew better than to do, and we did, and they didn't work, and all the things we were sure would work and were terrible disasters. And I think sharing that kind of information, the way that I like to think about that, is that we patent all of our mistakes, but we open source all of our successes. And that's how the movement moves forward, right? We have to be honest about what we get right and what we don't get right, so we can share that and move on and make new and interesting mistakes, more interesting mistakes.
Another term that you use in the book is forest gardening. What does that mean?
Well, we live here in the region of the Great Eastern Deciduous Forest, and we are attempting in our gardening to mimic some of the things that happen in a real forest. Some of the structures, like we might have in some areas, trees and then shrubs underneath them, and then herbaceous perennials underneath that, maybe some vines in there and some fungi. We're also, so that's some about the layers. We're also looking at the kinds of relationships between plants that happen in a real forest, like we were talking about for beneficial insects and nitrogen fixation and other fertility efforts, and some weed-suppressing living mulch ground covers. And finally, we look at the successional processes that happen in a forest where things change over time, and you might start with bare soil and end up with the great big trees and full shade 10 years later. So we have some areas where we're doing that pretty successfully here, like a persimmon tree with a couple of very nice shade-tolerant berries growing underneath and a beautiful, diverse collection of shade-tolerant perennial vegetables and beneficial insect plants growing under that, and then shiitake logs in there, too. And out in New Mexico, that would look a little different. You'd be using different species, but the same process applies wherever you might be. You look to the natural ecosystems that occur where you are and figure out how much of that you can mimic, including directly incorporating useful native species from your area. And we grow quite a number of useful native species here in our own garden.
The question of native versus non-native species is quite a controversial one in terms of people who are doing permaculture gardening, and there's a lot of, you know, reasonable argument on both sides, but you have a very interesting take on using non-native species in your garden, and it has to do with food and carbon footprint.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I would say is we always want to try and start with the useful native plants of your area before you go looking outside. So for us, that means persimmon, and it means pawpaw and some native nitrogen fixers and groundnuts and some other fun things. But what you'll typically find is that the native flora is not sufficient to feed you in its current state of domestication. And when our food is coming from, let's say here in the Northeast, your orange juice is also coming from Brazil, where there's huge monocultures of citrus in Brazil, which is where most of our orange juice comes from now. So if you want to grow some fruit, in our case, the hardy kiwi, that's very high in vitamin C, you're de-externalizing the ecological cost of your food production. So there's an ecological cost of cutting down all those ecosystems to put all that citrus in, and then there's a huge carbon footprint to ship that orange juice here, the orange juice concentrate here, from Brazil. So we need to look at these non-native plants not only in terms of the potential ecological cost of growing them, but we need to look at the ecological benefit of growing them, or even the ecological cost of not growing them.
Right.
I think if we look at the native plant garden has been held up as the highest example of the ecological garden, but if it's not growing food and your food comes from the supermarket, you're still part of the problem.
Exactly. And I think it's also important to talk about the reality that not every, you know, all these non-native species, they're not all harmful or invasive.
There are a lot, you know, something like only, is it 1 or 2 or 3% of non-native species ever become invasive? Mostly they
don't.
Exactly. And, you know, eventually over time, one of those species becomes a native species. The issue is that might take 10,000 years, and it might grow through a very annoying growth spurt phase. And when you have a whole lot of species all doing that at the same time in the context of a very fragmented ecosystem and climate change, it creates problems. But the real problem to me is human disturbance of the environment that these plants are mostly responding to. Now, would I ever grow kudzu on purpose? I don't think so. If I lived out where you folks are, would I plant Russian olive? Probably not. But I think this fantasy that we can have native plant gardens and we're helping the environment when our food is coming from the global food system is problematic to me.
So meanwhile, some of the food that you are growing, a lot of the food that you are growing is what you call perennial vegetables. Now, I never even thought about the difference between annual and perennial vegetables since I don't grow my own vegetables. What is the difference and what are some examples of each one?
Sure. Well, most of the vegetables we eat are annual vegetables, so tomatoes would be a great example, or lettuce, where you have to plant seed every year. The plant grows, and then in the case of tomatoes is an easy example. The tomatoes grow, then you you can pick the tomatoes, and the next year, no tomatoes will grow there. Maybe some rotted on the ground and a few sprout, but essentially tomatoes won't grow there again the next year. You have to save the seed and plant it again, or buy more seeds and plant them again. That's an annual vegetable. It only lives 1 year, whereas a perennial vegetable will keep coming back every year on its own from a bigger and bigger root system every year. And that's a very desirable trait because it means you don't have to replant, and the plant gets to start out with a healthy, robust root system in the first place, which makes it much tougher than a brand-new, tiny little 2-inch-high seedling of something annual. And that's a real benefit. And there's tons of different species of perennial vegetables. I wrote a book that has about 100 species in it. There are many, 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 many more that didn't make the cut into the book. Not all of them taste great. Not all of them are ready for prime time. And part of what we've been doing here is figuring out which ones we like and which ones grow well for us here. Because we have in our garden about 70 species of perennial edible leaves. That's a lot. That's a lot of diversity.
Yeah, especially on this very small plot that you have. Now, that is a story in itself. By the way, we are talking to Eric Tonesmeyer, author of the book Paradise Lot. So that story of your two plant geeks, as you call yourselves, and the 1/10 of an acre is so interesting because your friend Jonathan Bates, who also contributed to this book, is a guy who was just as interested as you in ecosystems, and he'd come from marine biology and was really now more into plants and farming. And the two of you decided that you wanted to create an urban garden and not live kind of out in the countryside anymore. Why did you decide that, and how did you choose the city that you ended up in?
Well, okay, the crassest version of why we wanted to move is it was very hard to meet sweethearts out in the middle of nowhere. And we were getting older and wanted to find people to settle down with, and that wasn't happening out in the country. But we also really felt, and we wanted to find a duplex with a shared backyard so we could plant fruit trees and so on and continue to garden together, but eventually each have our own side of the house. And that's worked out really well. That's worked out great. We both have our sweeties, we both have babies, and we continue to share the garden and have fun back there. So that's been a really good arrangement. We chose this city partly because I'd been working here in urban agriculture since 1994 with an organization called Nuestras Raíces, which means our roots. This is one of the sort of national hotbeds of urban agriculture, so we were very interested in that. It also happened to be a very affordable city, and we felt like picking a small piece of land like this, the backyard is only 90 by 45, and that's most of the gardening space. We felt like that would enable what we're doing to be relevant to lots and lots of people, whereas if we did something on 100 acres, not as many people have 100 acres as have 10 of an acre.
Right. And what was so interesting, I mean, this town, Holyoke, Massachusetts, is on the other side of what you call the tofu curtain. So there's a part of Western Massachusetts that's very progressive, and there's a lot of liberal arts colleges there and a lot of farmers markets and progressive thinking. And then you've got these other cities that have a lot of the urban problems like drugs and gangs and things like that. And Holyoke is a place with a lot of immigrants, a lot of Puerto Rican residents. And one of the things that is so cool about that is that these folks grew up actually farming themselves. And so to get people involved in urban gardening was really easy because that was those were their roots in the first place, nuestras raíces.
Yeah, these are the folks who don't look at us like we're crazy at all for growing all this stuff. They go, oh, yeah, you can eat that. That's great. You can eat that. That's great. Folks who grew up in the mountains in Puerto Rico, and the folks here mostly all grew up in these two tiny towns in the mountains of Puerto Rico, grew up foraging for passion fruits and wild yams, and grew up on these sort of very small subsistence homesteads, really, and have really an excellent living tradition of an agricultural culture. And the folks who, their children and their grandchildren who grew up here in the city have lost a lot of that. And much of our work at Nuestras Raíces has been passing on that tradition and that knowledge and that part of the culture to the younger generations of folks who are growing up here in the city.
There's a very important thing to talk about, which is the relationship between agriculture, food supply, permaculture, all those things, and social justice. Talk about that and the work that you're doing there.
Well, in terms of our garden, it's not so directly linked, I think, but in terms of the bigger picture, the work of Nuestras Raíces has really been about addressing food security issues in the city, about addressing some of the challenges that affect the community, like obesity and diabetes, in part through agriculture and increased production and consumption of vegetables. I feel like permaculture is a great set of tools, but for them to be fully realized, we want them to be in the hands of communities, especially communities who are hard hit or frontline communities like this community in Holyoke, to be a tool for self-determination. So a tool for people to be able to have their own capacity to produce food and energy and housing for themselves, to produce jobs. One of the things we've done here in town with Nuestras Raíces is we ran a training program with kids who are coming out of the juvenile justice system and trained them to install solar hot water systems. We ended up spinning off a company that does solar hot water installs, among other things. And they've hired five or six kids who've come out of that program to work for them. So now we're making the city greener and providing jobs in a community that is in desperate need of employment. So we're providing green employment and training in that community. And that's a really exciting opportunity. And eventually that business will be providing revenue. It's breaking even now, but eventually it'll be providing revenue for the nonprofit as well, which is a great thing. Anybody who runs a nonprofit knows writing grants all the time is really tedious and time-consuming. And so to have some money-making businesses that are doing something positive is a great opportunity as well.
The book Paradise Lot really makes one think a lot about the food system and local food production. And here you are having this garden on a tenth of an acre that mimics the ecosystems around you very consciously. And a lot of the food that you eat, not all the food, but a lot of the food you eat is from that garden. And you were talking about like the carbohydrates that you have to buy. You know, you're buying bread. You're not growing wheat there. But if you thought about it and did it and planned it consciously, you could have nut trees and all kinds of other actually food-bearing plants and trees and so on in a city planned as part of even a real estate development that would provide ever more food for the inhabitants of that city. I find that amazing and very important and fascinating.
I'm really enthusiastic about this. I think edible street trees are a great idea, and especially if you were to look at street trees that provide some kind of staple crop, so much the better. In our case, in our backyard, we have too much shade and not enough space to grow a lot of nut trees. But you could do as street trees in our town. You could grow lots of chestnuts, which would be, I calculated something like, it would be enough to grow something like 35 or 40 loaf of bread equivalents for everyone on the street if we just had planted them instead of silly maple trees and stuff that we have out there right now. That's pretty interesting. A great example of someone who's done that is Brad Lancaster in Tucson, Arizona, who's
right.
installed these rainwater capturing earthworks along the streets to catch road runoff and grow mesquite trees, which is a native nitrogen-fixing staple food that grows on a tree, which is just awesome. And they've really used that as a way to transform neighborhoods and build community and get people talking about water and food and other issues while having parties and using their, hammer mill to grind the mesquite pods and having a big mesquite pancake breakfast together. I think that's a great, great model of community organizing around permaculture.
Now, how did your garden, which after a pretty short time became very distinct from all of its neighbors, in the front yard you've got a semi-tropical garden, in the backyard you've got gazillions of plant species and wildlife coming in and all this stuff in basically a suburban duplex. How did that affect your neighbors and the community around you, the example of what you were doing? How did you connect with them?
I wish I could say that it had really transformed our neighborhood, and I think we really thought it would quite a bit more than it has. Some folks have planted some more fruit trees and stuff. A lot of the neighbors' kids come and eat berries. We even planted a whole hedge in the front yard, a berry hedge, just for the neighbors' kids to come and eat. But we don't see the kind of transformation of people's yards, I think partly because a lot of our neighbors rent. And the renters can't do what they want with the land. We must have had 2,000 or 2,500 people at this point come through and visit the garden from other places, which we didn't anticipate at all. So we've had much less local impact than we thought we would, and a much greater sort of national or global impact than we thought.
When you talk about the fact that people who are renting, they really can't do what they want, and they also don't know how long they're going to be there. And if that was your problem that you had on the farm that you were on before you bought this duplex, this whole book and all the thinking in it really, to me, underlined the importance of, and the general lack in our society, of long-term thinking. When you are thinking about a garden, you're not thinking about what am I going to do this year. You're thinking about a process of many years. In fact, you spent an entire year really just pretty much observing the sun and the ground and the yard before you even really planted anything.
We did. In that first year, we put in a nursery area to move our plants from our old house. And we knew we'd have to improve all the soil here everywhere anyway, so that wasn't a big deal. But we did spend a year in observation and in the design process to really thoroughly learn about the site, partly because I was writing another book at the time, and I was playtesting the design process here. But we wanted to spend the time and see what is this pattern of sun and shade in the summer and in the winter. And we learned that the backyard has a alternating pattern. One half is sunny in the summer and shady in the winter, and the other half is sunny in the winter and shady in the summer. And there's only one tiny piece of land that is sunny in summer and winter. And since we knew from our goals articulation process that we wanted a greenhouse, there was only one place where that could go. And that way, this sort of blank slate of this 45 by 90 desolated crabgrass expanse of our backyard started to become less of a uniform, monotonous piece. And we started to learn that there were areas of different soils and areas of different light. And then the overlay of the pattern of light and the pattern of soil gave us these very distinct patches with unique characteristics. And permaculture design is about learning to harmonize your goals with what the site has to offer and with what the site needs. So we had to figure out, just like when you're designing a polyculture between different plants and you want it to work for all of them, we needed something that would work for us and work for the land and bring it back to life, bring it back to being a healthy ecosystem while providing our needs at the same time. And that was really fun and super interesting, and I highly recommend it to everybody.
We're talking to Eric Tonesmeyer about his book, Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One-Tenth of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Moving on to the bigger picture, how does the kind of work that you guys are doing in permaculture and all the people that you're associating with, how does that speak to issues, for example, of climate change?
That's the issue that has me most worked up at this point that I'm really thinking about. I'm about to launch a Kickstarter campaign about that in just a couple of days for a book I'm working on that's looking at these kinds of perennial agriculture, what we call regenerative agriculture, that is soil-building agricultural practices, mostly with perennials. What's the potential impact of that on climate change? Because we need to not only reduce our emissions of fossil fuels, but we need to actively sequester carbon, 200 or more gigatons of carbon need to be pulled out of the atmosphere. And a great place to hold that carbon is perennial vegetation like trees and non-tilled soil, which can hold a lot of organic matter. So I'm looking at what are the perennial staple crops of the world, what could we replace or supplement wheat and corn and soybeans with, products that grow on trees, and what's the current state of domestication of those crops. Basically, in the tropics, they're awesome, and in the colder climates, they're not as good, and people are working on it. What's the toolkit of practices and species that we can use to sort of save the planet from disastrous climate change by turning it into an edible paradise? And I find that a very compelling and interesting vision.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's the ultimate win-win kind of model.
I think so. And if you were to compare that to the kinds of geoengineering projects people are talking about, which we may need and we may be glad for, but, you know, giant orbiting solar mirrors and these, and, you know, airplanes to spray sulfur in the sky to increase albedo and stuff like that. Those are projects that we could look at and we could assess their multiple benefits and say, are they helping the world's poorest people to become more self-reliant, yes or no? Are they increasing or shrinking the gap between wealthy and poor? Are they providing benefits for agriculture? Are they providing benefits for soil stabilization? Are they restoring degraded land? Are they feeding people? And we would look at multifunctional regenerative agriculture, and it would win a lot of those conversations. There's a lot of challenges involved in converting a quarter of the world's surface to a new kind of agriculture. It's a big challenge, but I think it's a really essential. We have to beat climate change, to stabilize the climate, we have to transform every aspect of how we live our lives. And agriculture is a big component of that. I'm also looking at these industrial crops. Much of the petroleum that we use on a daily basis is not for fuel, but is in the form of plastic and fibers and synthetic rubber. And how can we use plants to serve as the basis of sort of a bio industry? It turns out you can make some kinds of bioplastic in your kitchen with cornstarch, gelatin, and glycerol.
Really?
You can have all kinds. And so what's the right scale, you know, for some of these technologies? Some can be done on a much more decentralized basis. So I'm sort of imagining, you know, throughout, let's say, the tropical developing world, these village-level or municipal-level, community-level bioplastic facilities that make non-toxic, bio-based, biodegradable plastics, compostable plastics. There's this amazing tree called the diesel tree, which you can tap like maple syrup, but what comes out, you run through a filter and you can put it right in a diesel engine and run a diesel engine.
Amazing.
That's pretty cool. We don't have anything like that up here yet, although the most promising candidate for a hydrocarbon crop in cold climates are milkweeds, which I know you have as many of out here, as out where you are, as we do out here.
Right.
They're very high in long-chain hydrocarbons in the latex. They make excellent fiber crops as well. So there's some effort afoot to domesticate milkweed and develop it as a new crop to substitute for petroleum, which I think is really cool.
I mean, one of the other things that's so interesting and I think important to really note about the work that you're doing is you are observing what some of the indigenous cultures were like that preceded you in what is now New England. We're doing that out here. You refer to the corn, squash, and beans trio that worked so well out in the Southwest. And so it's always this combination of looking at where you are, looking at how it's been done in the past, and looking at these new technologies all at the same time.
That's what's interesting about permaculture is you're drawing on the best of what's been done on the past and the best of what's sort of at the very cutting edge of what's happening now in the future. And this book, Tending the Wild, which is about the indigenous management, land management in California, this really changed my life in terms of understanding that on many parts of this continent, there's a history of, let's say, 12,000 years of people managing the land in a way that is good for the land and good for people. And when I grew up as an environmentalist, I learned that the best you can do is to shrink your footprint down to nothing, which is both unappealing and impossible. And I now know has no historical basis on this continent either.
Right.
I like the idea. They say, you know, your footprint is your negative impact. How big is your handprint? You need to make your handprint bigger than your footprint. And I think we need to find ways to do this kind of regenerative design work where we make an active, where we increase our impact on the environment, but we make it a positive impact. And I think out of New Mexico, people have seen that a lot with, there was a critique for a long time of overgrazing, but it turns out that rotational grazing can have a really positive impact on the landscape in terms of replacing the vanished megafauna of the area, replacing the bison and so on in a certain way. And I think that kind of stuff
exactly.
is very, very interesting to me. These win-win strategies for people in the environment.
Another part of the book is about the relationships that you formed. And so you and your great friend Jonathan Bates bought this duplex, living together as two guys and renting out the other half, hoping that you would someday meet the loves of your lives, which you did in a way that was almost like choreographed. It was amazing. I mean, you met these ladies and they moved in almost around the same time and you had children at the same time. And then the question arises for a reader of this book is, what is your commitment to each other? In other words, is this like a long-term relationship between your families? Do you think you might go your separate ways?
I think it's very likely that we'll go our separate ways within a couple of years. My wife, Monty Claire, is completing grad school and is working in international development and would really like to return to that kind of work, which there isn't that kind of work here. And we're also itching to get our hands on more land and to be somewhere much warmer because Massachusetts is terribly, awfully cold in the winter. And she's from Guatemala. She doesn't like it. I don't like it either. I have no excuse like that, but I don't like it either. Whereas Jonathan and Meg next door have access to her family farm in Ithaca that has, I don't know, 150 acres sitting there and that they could go and plug in on and expand their nursery and so on. So I think in the long term we'll be splitting up, but there's absolutely a long-term commitment. I can't imagine that we would go without talking if we live far away. We would go without talking for more than a few days. And Jonathan and I, we hang out and talk all the time, and we work in the garden together all the time. And I can't imagine how I would have a garden without him. I can't even conceive of how I would manage a garden without him. So there's going to be a lot of things to be figured out, and we're also not anxious to rush out of here. Finally, the kiwis are starting to make fruit. We got our first kiwis last year, and everything yields better every year. So we are not in a rush to go and run on, but we won't be here forever. Hopefully we'll find somebody to take the place who wants to take good care of it and not just, you know, put it in a swimming pool or something in the backyard.
Right, right. I love that you have a little pond. And then in the pond, you bought fish, and the purpose of the fish was to eat mosquitoes. And again, that's just part of the whole system. So it's not, it's got to be beautiful. I haven't seen it except in pictures, but nothing is purely decorative. Everything has a function, including your little goldfish.
In the summer, it's really lovely. Even now with snow on it, it's pretty back there. And in the greenhouse, it's gorgeous right now. It's full of fantastic vegetables and the little avocado trees breaking bud on the flower buds and stuff in there. It's really quite nice.
So what does all of this say to those of us who are really not plant geeks, who have full-time jobs, who would like to do something with the space that we have? I mean, is this permaculture an all or nothing thing? I mean, you and Jonathan have devoted your entire lives and kind of thought processes to thinking about and understanding these systems. What about those of us who can't do that? What can we do, if anything?
Well, I think it would be ridiculous. It's even ridiculous for us to be as into it as we are. I don't think anybody needs, 70 kinds of edible leaves in their backyard. We're sort of an R&D center, I think, in some ways for the movement. But I think people can do lots of things. I think people can start, composting and worm farming and taking some of their household waste and turning it into fertility in their yard. I think people can plant some fruits and plant some berries and plant some perennial vegetables that aren't going to take up that much time. And if each year you put in one little bed with some perennial vegetables and some berries and a fruit tree or something, in 5 years you've got five beds. So you can spend a little bit of time every spring and a little bit of money every spring and get something pretty great in a relatively small amount of time. And that's quite a lot of fun. And certainly out where you are, starting with some rainwater harvesting is going to be the best way to do that and keep things irrigated in the long term. If you design a nice low-maintenance system and don't take on too much, you could do quite a bit. I can't imagine why there are any yards that don't have fruit trees in them anywhere in the whole world.
Right.
But no, you don't need a PhD and you don't need all this kind of stuff to be able to do this at all. I think just going out and trying something and not being afraid to make some mistakes and have some things die. You won't know what grows for you until you've killed some things. They say Plant Delight's nursery is a nursery I like. They say you don't know if something will grow for you until you've personally killed it three times.
Oh.
And I think that's a really good guideline to use. Jonathan and I use that guideline all the time. Oh, we've only killed that twice. Let's try one more time.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah, so there's a kind of keep at it persistence that's part of this. I wondered, how has eating so much food out of your own yard, how does that affect your health?
I think we eat more vegetables than we would have. And we eat a lot more fruit than we would have. And we're eating the very freshest fruits and vegetables while we do that. The very freshest imaginable fruits and vegetables. And I can only imagine that's good for you. We have eggs too, so in the summer, we'll do a lot of cooking with vegetables and eggs, which is real healthy, frittatas and omelets and scrambled eggs and fried rice and all those things. We're eating a great diversity of different kinds of leaves and fruits all the time. That was our main goal, was to grow lots of different fruits and leaves, because those are the things that are that much better when they're that fresh. And the 1 year our greenhouse was destroyed, the one winter, I had to go and buy greens at the supermarket for the first time in 11 years. And I have to say, I was so spoiled when I went in there and I looked at the quality and lack of freshness of those greens. I realized I'd become really an insufferable purist as to my salads. If it's more than 10 minutes old, I'm not interested in it anymore.
Right.
So I can only assume that's good for you. Scientists and doctors seem to think the fresher the veggies are, the better for you. So, and the more diversity, the better, because each one has slightly different nutritional profiles and so on.
And in defiance of the local laws, you did very quietly keep female chickens in your garden, and that's part of the whole ecosystem, not only the eggs, but the manure and what they eat and everything.
Yeah, they really helped us get. We had a problem early on, about 3 years in, where we had way more vegetation than we could handle, including way more edible leaves than we could handle. So by feeding it to chickens, they turn a lot of it into eggs and then into manure, and they make this beautiful compost. So all that made complete sense. It happened that they were illegal, and we when Meg and Monty Claire moved in, they basically said, you guys are, too timid, and we're going to just go ahead and do this. So that's what we did. And actually, our neighbors were busted for selling drugs at that time. There was a big drug raid, lots of cops running around with guns and stuff. And while they were there, one of them called in the chickens, and we had to pay a $0 fine, which was pretty acceptable. And they said if they get a complaint, they'll come back and give us a $25 fine. And we felt like we were willing to continue with an act of civil disobedience given that particular fee structure.
So,
and we haven't had any trouble since then. In the last 4 or 5 years, we haven't had any more trouble.
Eric, what were the biggest surprises for you in taking on this whole project of the duplex and the little yard and working with Jonathan and all of what led to this book, Paradise Lot?
I think I was surprised by how fast it started to work. I was surprised that within 3 years it started to look like how we wanted to look. And within 3 years we started to get a double handful of berries every day in June and July. I was also really surprised by how much other people were interested in what we were trying to do. We felt like really just a couple of nerds doing this botanical experiment on our own, and it turns out that so many people have come and wanted to see what we're doing and then convinced us to write this book, and the book's been received really well. So it's sort of a validation for a botanical mad scientist, if you will, that people have been so enthused. And I'll also say that I just really love walking out the back door and eating fruit. Sometimes I'll pull in with my car, and in the right time of year, I can open the door of the car and pick fruit and eat it right in my driveway. And I'm thrilled that it turned out so well, and that even though some things, some individual things didn't work, on the whole, yes, you can garden your entire yard, and yes, you can produce food in the shade, and yes, you can turn terrible compacted soil into beautiful, productive chocolate cake. That's pretty exciting. I've just been surprised that it worked, to be honest, that it worked so well.
The book is called Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, 1/10 of an Acre, and the Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Eric Tonesmeyer, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And do you want to share your website?
Sure. It's perennialsolutions.org.
Perennialsolutions.org. Eric, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much for having me.